coming up on Weekend America.
This weekend, a ritzy community deals with new neighbors.
The break-ins, which just occurred, the busted windows, the guys down the street, the tailgating, the pit bulls. I think that's all I can think of right now.
How foreclosures are affecting one Las Vegas neighborhood. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm John Moe. Also this hour, Iraq war veterans recall an unforgettable day.
Only a few hours into Iraq, I find myself with this mnemonic playing through my head, which is, we'd been told, if we see an AK-47, shoot it. And I came within a second of shooting a guy from Chicago.
First and last days in Iraq. And this weekend, do you have a golf Jones?
Just like taking dope, you know what I mean? Playing golf. A guy falls in love with it so much. I mean, it's just something you just can't get away from.
The monkey on one man's back became his career.
Time to tee off on Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
In St. Paul, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe, in for Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper, also in St. Paul. This weekend, an encore. We're bringing you some of our favorite stories, from a look at the first and last day some American soldiers served in Iraq before coming home, to how one man got hustled on the links and became a golfing legend. What about you? What are you doing this weekend?
Well, this weekend I'm going to be doing some chores around the house. I have to build a cat scratch post.
I think this weekend we're going to the Empire State Building.
Comic books, videos, movies.
I'm visiting my friends.
This weekend we're going to go see a gymnastic meet.
I will be watching some soccer on Saturday morning.
We're going to go visit relatives.
Or maybe going to a couple parties, but definitely not buying anything because I have no money. I'll be working this weekend too to get money to buy things in future weekends.
That guy's got his whole system worked out. That's the American economy in that
I'm
one
feeling
guy.
Him. Definitely. Those voices came from Minneapolis, New York, and Concord, New Hampshire.
I wonder if that guy was thinking of buying a house. Because if you pick up a newspaper this weekend or any weekend, you will likely see a really big real estate section. In recent months, though, that part of the paper has been bringing a lot of bad news. The real estate market has struggled, prices and sales down, foreclosures up, and more vacant homes sometimes means more crime and lower property values and worried neighbors. They want people in those houses that are in the process of foreclosure. So real estate agents are reaching out to potential buyers and chartering buses for tours of foreclosed homes. Mari Saito rode along with one such weekend tour in the western suburbs of Cleveland.
It's a gorgeous Saturday afternoon in Northeast Ohio. Myself and 30 other people have decided to spend it on a bus with a couple real estate agents, a home inspector, and a mortgage broker.
Yeah, just a few things. Now, my name is Pat Fury. We want to thank you for coming on board our foreclosure bus.
Pat Fury and co-workers from Remax Crossroads in Strongsville, Ohio, have rented the bus, brought lunch, and scheduled appointments for us to look at houses in different states of foreclosure.
We're going to see properties today from 117.5 up to 270. So it just makes us aware that foreclosure doesn't affect just one segment or another. It's across the board.
Shopping for a foreclosed house is not for the faint of heart. One house stinks of mold and damp, and many of us don't go in. At another, we trudge through thick leaves that have yet to be raked off the driveway of a bank-owned ranch-style house. Inside, wires hang from ceilings for light fixtures long gone.
Is there a basement?
I don't know. There's no lights, though. You can't tell.
Oh, the power's out.
There's something weird about walking through houses that people have lost for financial reasons. But tour goer Marianne Mozak says what she likes is that the trip seems more focused on solving the problem.
I think someone described this as the tour of tears, which is kind of, you know, a sad way to put it. You know, you don't want to capitalize or be predatory on someone else's loss. But at the same time, I'm sure that the people in this neighborhood want to have people who are able to, you know, keep their property up and make payments.
Most people on the tour are looking for a home to live in, not to rent or flip. Back on the bus, there's a man sitting across from me. He's writing notes on his property information sheet.
So I see you guys put a big X on that one, huh?
Put a big X.
Big X.
Well, that means that's
not really
what we want.
The spot. They're coming back.
That's not really what we were looking for.
As the bus continues on through tree-lined streets, people working in their yards stop what they're doing and stare. This foreclosure tour, like others around the country, has gotten lots of press coverage, and people recognize the bus.
Lots of friendly people on our street. We love our street. We love our neighborhood.
Lots of kids.
That's the next-door neighbor at one of the homes we visit. Laura Ryder and a gaggle of kids on bikes and scooters wave to buyers as we walk into the house next door to hers.
It hit me as soon as you stopped. I've heard of this, but I didn't realize this house was on that list. So, I'm looking at it as a hopeful sign. You're bringing a lot of people over here.
What surprises me is how nice the neighborhoods we drive into are. Some of the homes on the tour are beautiful. They have ponds in the backyard and three-car garages. Others are just dated, like the one with a well-worn, wall-to-wall neon aqua rug. Wow, how do you pick this color for carpet?
You know, the scary thing is we've been looking at houses for a couple months.
And we've seen this is pretty popular.
Yeah.
Must have been a sale that day.
Realtors say there have been no purchases yet from the foreclosure tours, but they've had plenty of calls of interest. Tickets for next Saturday's tour are already sold out.
That one scare you a little bit?
Yeah.
Well, that's when I put a big star on the top of the page for my investors.
For Week in America, I'm Mari Saito in Cleveland.
Look at this neighborhood.
Beautiful.
It's a beautiful neighborhood, and what this house is going to end up going for in the long run is going to be a steal.
That's tough news for Cleveland, but they're not alone. The housing crisis is lingering over a lot of cities, including Las Vegas. It has some of the nation's highest foreclosure rates. So now if you're a buyer and you're looking for a multimillion-dollar property in Las Vegas this weekend, you might be offered some extra incentives, like VIP services, impossible to get dinner reservations, front row seats at shows, no wait at nightclubs. It's like the whole nine yards. That's what it's taking as foreclosures ravage even the city's priciest neighborhoods. Week in America's Chrissy Clark visited the upscale Las Vegas suburb of Southern Highlands.
The first and most obvious fact of life in the gated community of San Nicolo is, of course, the gate. To get inside the gate, if you're not a homeowner, you have to dial up your host at a call box.
Hello?
Hi, is this Karen?
Yes.
Hi, it's Chrissy.
Okay, I'll press you in. Hang on.
Thanks.
The gate is what gives the new Spanish-style homes just inside a sense of security, exclusivity, and, a few years ago, price tags of $500,000 and up.
And the gates are swinging open.
Access granted. Please enter.
At least, that's how the gate used to work, recalls Karen Lewis, until a weekend last summer.
I came home one night. The gate was broken.
Karen moved into a house behind this gate 2 years ago with her husband and 4-year-old son. Their dream house, she calls it. High ceilings, a view of the mountains, a private golf course nearby. But that night, the night of the broken gate, was a kind of turning point for Karen. Some kids had rammed through the gate to get to a raging party next door to her house. They were racing up and down her block in their cars. And she realized the gated community she'd moved into was changing fast.
It just wasn't what I expected. The gate being continuously broken, the party.
The break-ins, which just occurred, the busted windows.
That's one of Karen's neighbors.
The mysterious neighbors across the street who don't speak and come in the middle of the night. The roommates, the broken-down cars, the pit bulls.
To understand how San Nicolo went from a place you'd expect to see golden retrievers to a place where pit bulls are the in-vogue pet, you need to back up a few years. Families like Karen's were buying new homes here, and so were small investors, 2 and 3 houses at a time. The places were selling like hotcakes, or another substance, as Butch, a guy who lives a few doors down, likes to say.
Wow, it's like, who needs to be a drug dealer when you can buy real estate in Las Vegas? Not that I sell drugs.
Butch bought 3 houses in the neighborhood, with adjustable rate mortgages, planned to sell them for a quick profit. He lives in one of them, shares it with 2 roommates. Now that the monthly rate has ballooned, Butch can't afford it anymore. He stopped paying his mortgage in January. He guesses the bank will get around to seizing his house in another few months. 24 of the 214 homes in San Nicolo are currently in foreclosure. Many more are vacant. Karen and her son Cooper walk around the neighborhood trying to guess which ones they are.
It's probably a foreclosure, but I'm not sure. If you see the lawn's dead.
A dead lawn is a telltale sign of a foreclosed house. Cooper thinks he's found one.
The empty house. I found one.
Crumbling stucco is another sign of a foreclosed house. Homeowners forced out by the bank sometimes take their frustrations out on their walls. Karen points to a gash on the side of a porch.
This has to be willful because this house is only 4 years old. There's no way it could have this sort of damage.
It's not just foreclosures that are affecting San Nicolo. With the sagging market, investors who've avoided foreclosure still can't sell their vacant houses, so they're renting instead. Houses designed for single families are being rented to college kids or multiple families at a time.
So on the corner, we believe that it's a halfway house. There are about six cars. It seems like a bit of an AA meeting. I fully support AA, and I think it's a wonderful thing, but they don't say hi.
Later, I go to the house that Karen thinks is a halfway house.
Hi, I'm Chrissy. I'm a reporter.
Shh. Oh, sorry.
A woman named Georgina and her 12-year-old granddaughter, Topaz, crack the door open.
Everybody's asleep.
Oh, sorry about that.
Everybody work in the nighttime.
Oh, where do they work? Where do they work?
They are taxi drivers.
Okay. They're graveyard.
Yeah, everybody's sleeping.
They started renting this house a year ago. And they love it.
Yeah, because we have more rooms here and we are more together.
And how
we are going to buy the house.
Probably. You're going to buy the house?
Yeah, we're going to buy the house. Yeah, we really like the neighbor.
How many people live here?
Nine.
No.
Yes.
Cállate.
But I've been
seven.
Okay. Seven.
These days, San Nicolo is about as ungated community-like as a gated community can be. But now that all these people from different backgrounds are stuck here together inside the gate, interesting things have begun to happen. When I ask Karen Lewis how she thinks the real estate crisis has affected her life, she pauses. She doesn't mention the fact that her house was recently reappraised for $115,000 less than she bought it for. What she mentions is this.
There are some biases that I had that I didn't realize. You sort of stereotype people whether they can afford to live in a certain neighborhood or not. Like the neighbor next to me. They have a detailing business, so they would actually have their customers come to their house, and they would clean the cars, and they would have music playing, and they'd be sitting out in their lawn chairs drinking beer and talking to their friends in the middle of, you know, a Saturday afternoon. I didn't expect to have that kind of traffic in my street, but they're awesome neighbors. They're the ones that slow down when they see a kid.
Who cares if they leave oil stains on the pavement, a clear violation of homeowner association rules? Karen says the really important thing inside these gates is having a few neighbors she can trust to look out for her and for the occasional pit bull. In Southern Highlands, Nevada, I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
We want to give a special thanks to Marshall Allen of the Las Vegas Sun for first reporting on San Nicolo.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat.
Kicked out of two schools, living out of a van, working in biker bars. Not the most practical career choices, but they make for some great music. Coming up on Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul, Minnesota, along with Desiree Cooper. This is the show about what America is doing this weekend. Now, I'm told that for some people, the weekend is a time where they actually go out. They leave their homes, they go to other buildings, and they listen to live music where people play instruments. I have three young kids, so I have no idea if this actually happens or if it's just legend.
Well, my kids are grown, but now I can't stay up past 10 o'clock, so I have no idea.
Okay,
either.
you're no help. Well, if you are in one of these nightclubs this weekend, you might be lucky enough to hear a red-haired woman playing a mean guitar, and her name's Carolyn Wonderland. She's a singer, songwriter, musician, and she has a history of speaking out. And if Carolyn is not in your town this weekend, don't worry. She will be soon. She tours all the time. We managed to catch up with Carolyn Wonderland recently in Austin, Texas.
Well, I used to go sneak around and play on my mom's Martin when she wasn't at home, and I would oftentimes be scolded or grounded from it when I wouldn't be doing my chores or if I hadn't washed my hands upon grubbing on it last time. And when she came home, I guess I was about 8 years old, I started really writing songs on it and really starting to want to play it every day. And I broke a string. I remember that very, very distinctly because I was so proud of myself. I got the right gauge and I strung it back on there. I strung it backwards. She didn't find out for 2 days. I never heard the end of that. So that was the Christmas that I got my own guitar. Well, what first attracted me to the blues as a youngster playing guitar was the fact that it was a chance to get to play with a group of people. You've only got so many chords. You've only got so many patterns you can do. But it's what you do with those colors that make it. And that's an expression that can't be quantified in math and can't be quantified in a chart. That's your actual soul coming out, you know? So that's what attracted me to the blues. It's always been kind of just an evolution of the sound always, but it's never strayed too far from the first things that I heard, you know? I mean, Still Alive and Well is a song that we recorded on the new record on Misunderstood, and that's like one of the first guitar riffs that I ever, you know, went around the house on my mom's guitars, you know, going, hey, hey, is this how it goes? You know, or hey. And she's like, why don't you take up finger painting?
When every woman thought was cool as 6 feet underground, they tried to catch me lots of times, but I'm coming back for you. And I made it out, and I'm here to say, maybe you can get out too. I'm still alive and well. I'm still alive and well. So every now and then, I know it's kind of hard to tell, but I'm still alive and well.
I got thrown out of school for leading a protest on a campus after I was suspended for leading or participating in a protest at another campus. I was asked to leave right when I turned 17. I think they said, here's the legal age where we can kick her out, and they did. Getting kicked out of school, well, that means more time to devote to the guitar, and I think it turned out okay. I don't recommend it, but I think it turned out okay. My dad is about as hard-headed as I am. He'd actually got himself thrown out of school as well. So when he came up here from Chile, kind of runs in the family. And his advice was, well, if you think you know everything, then you ought to get out there and get yourself a job and prove it. It's like, okay. Mm-hmm. A lot of the places that would hire me when I was underage were biker bars. By and far, it was never a consideration that I was a chick. And most of the folks there, you know, treated me like I was, you know, the dirty kid sister, which was killer for me. I never had to wear makeup. I never had to do any of that crap. You know, I showed up, I plug in my guitar, I play for 4 hours, get my pay, go home. It was lovely. And, you know, it wasn't until being on the road, I suppose, that I started to see, you know, a little change in treatment. Before you start playing, people might look at you odd. You're like, oh, you know, great, we've got another strumming guitar playing chick. Hoorah. I mean, you know, don't break a nail, honey. You know. But in a sense, there's always something to prove to someone somewhere. So if you take the situation and it lights a fire under your butt, well, then good for it. part of living your dream sometimes is realizing that you have to live cheaply. And sometimes you go to extremes to prove things to yourself. Maybe you put yourself out more than you have to give yourself the blues.
Go tell my mother, go tell my pa.
I can think, for example, I was in my van for the good part of 2 years, and it was partially by choice and partially by the fact that there just wasn't a lot of money to be made playing music, you know, or at least the way I was going about it, I sure couldn't find it. and so the result of that was just to go on tour all the time, you know, and be okay with that. So even at the point where some people would have considered me homeless, I choose to consider myself vanful at the time, because I always had wheels and I was always on the road.
Cooking his trio since Jimi Hendrix hit the stage. Take it away, Carolyn Wonderland Band.
I love getting to play live. I love freaking out. When you're playing, you just don't care. It's really secondary. I really care more about what I sound like than what I look like on any given moment. I'm not thinking. I mean, it's at the end of the song. I'm always surprised. I get like a second, you know, where it's like, okay, I'm back. What song did we play? What song should we play next? I don't usually have set lists, so sometimes I have to look around the band and go, we didn't play this yet, right? Because you're outside of yourself, you know, and that's, to me, that's success. It may never come with money, but it sure comes with that, you know, and you get to jump out there and do that all the time. That's really lucky.
You can see performance videos of Carolyn at weekendamerica.org. Carolyn Wonderland's latest album is called Misunderstood, and in a roundabout way, Bob Dylan made that record happen, actually. Dylan was in town in Austin, Texas, where Carolyn lives, for a show, and he called her up and he asked her over to jam. Imagine
Whoa.
That. Wouldn't that be nice? And they hit it off. They got along great. And Dylan introduced her to his friend, Ray Benson, who is with the Grammy-winning country swing band Asleep at the Wheel.
Uh-huh.
And then Benson agreed to produce her record. And here is a song from Misunderstood. This is Still Alive and Well.
Did you ever stop and take a look who's left around? When everyone thought was cool, 6 feet underground. They tried to catch me lots of times, but I'm coming back for you. Well, I made it out and I'm here to say, maybe you can get out too. I'm still alive and well. I'm still alive and well. Sit there and now and then, I know it's kind of hard to tell, but I'm still alive and well. Said I'm still alive and well. I'm still alive.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MBA Program.
For soldiers in a war zone, every day creates new memories, but perhaps none more vivid than the day they arrive and the day they leave. Soldiers reflect on those 2 days ahead on Weekend America.
Welcome to the weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper with John Moe. Now, this weekend, you are certain to be tending to your most animalistic needs: food, clothing, and shelter. But who's tending to those needs for the animals? Evidently, the folks at the Oakland Zoo in California are on the case, especially when it comes to clothing for a very special resident of the zoo. Weekend America's Chrissy Clark has the story.
The giraffe exhibit at the Oakland Zoo strives for a certain authenticity. The yard includes gazelle, a griffin vulture, and several loud Egyptian geese, the same animals giraffes hang out with in the African veldt. But the zookeeper, Amy Phelps, knows not everything is like it would be in nature. First off, at the zoo, the giraffes get snacks for good behavior.
Cinnamon raisin bagels, bananas, carrots, bread.
Unlike the wild, giraffes here are safe from predators. They sleep in stalls. And when it's cold out, there's this coat.
It's very large, difficult to move around. It's green, hunter green. Has just the right amount of quilting for the winter and some little Velcro straps on it to keep it secured to her.
It looks like a giant North Face parka or a very large bolero jacket. And along the hemline, the name Tiki is embroidered in a tasteful beige.
Yeah.
Amy says she just couldn't resist. Tiki has enormous brown eyes and thick brown lashes and a long black tongue. She's the zoo's oldest giraffe, 19. That's about 60 in giraffe years. She's a great-great-grandmother. Her progeny live in zoos up and down the West Coast.
She comes from a long line of Bay Area-born giraffes. You'd think she'd be used to the foggy weather, but...
But as Tiki gets older, she's become hypersensitive to the cold, thanks to something called ringbone disease, a kind of giraffe arthritis. Her feet hurt. Her ankles are swollen. She shuffles when she walks.
So it's a really short kind of ch-ch-ch-ch. She's really easy to tell.
And when Tiki shivers, it's painful. The Oakland Zoo has tried treating the condition with Western medicine, among other things.
Tiki gets a chiropractor, she has an acupuncturist, she has a homeopath, she has a masseuse.
And that's where the giraffe coat comes in. The zoo tries not to call it a coat, too anthropomorphic, but everyone calls it a coat anyway.
We don't want people to think that we're dressing her up in clothes because we think it's cute or because we think it's funny. That would be very disrespectful to her.
Tiki would not comment for this story. Giraffes don't talk. But Amy says Tiki expresses a lot with her body language, and Tiki's feelings about the coat become clear when we approach with it. Tiki stomps her hoof in the dust.
What's that all about?
Amy says the first time she tried to put the coat on Tiki...
She backed away a little bit, and she kind of gave us what we call the eye, which means they kind of turn their head sideways and look at you like, if you think I'm going to stand there and wear that thing, no.
The sound of the Velcro was scary, and the way the coat rubbed her hair in the wrong direction was just plain annoying. So Amy has been training Tiki to wear the coat over the last several weeks. Tiki's making progress, but it still takes three people to dress her when I watch a training session.
Your job is going to be to hold like this, so okay, that these don't slap her, but also so that if she spooks and runs away, the coat will come off.
Okay.
We don't want her to feel like it's attacking her. Good girl, T. Good, steady girl.
After about 5 minutes of maneuvering, Tiki is in her hunter green coat, looking about as absurd as a giraffe in a hunter green coat. The straps around her belly aren't fastened. That'll take a few more training sessions.
This is about as far as we've gotten, getting her used to wearing it.
Amy says she realizes that a giraffe in a coat may be fodder for critics of zoos. Should an animal from the desert really be in a position to need a coat in the first place?
It's kind of funny, you know, although I'm a zookeeper, I definitely understand the argument against zoos. And I think that all I can say about that is that, in my opinion, at least in the near future, zoos aren't going to go away.
And in the meantime, Tiki's cold.
Tiki, we're going to take it off. Okay, big girl? Here we go.
At the Oakland Zoo, I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
Good girl. Good job.
Aw, that green coat goes perfectly with Tiki's big brown eyes. See for yourself at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Thank you.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
I'm John Moe with Desiree Cooper. The war in Iraq has been going on since 2002. That's longer than American involvement in World Wars I or II. And often, the people you hear talking about the war on TV or the radio are retired generals, pundits, politicians. And that's fine, but what about the rank-and-file personnel, the people with the boots on the ground? In March of 2008, we gathered three people who served, and we asked them for their reflections on their experiences. Brian Turner, Sandy Austin, and Dylan Tett were all stationed in Iraq, all with the Army. We asked them about their memories of their first day in combat and their last. We start with Brian Turner.
I remember the first day we were in Kuwait, and we crossed the border on the 3rd of December, 2003. And somehow out of the entire brigade, out of those several hundred vehicles or so, my platoon was in the very front. And so only a few hours into Iraq, I find myself with this mnemonic playing through my head, which is we'd been told if we see an AK-47, shoot it. That was sort of a mnemonic to know who the enemy was, basically. And it was horrible advice because I found myself looking down the road and seeing a car on the left-hand side of the road, a civilian car, with four guys off to the right of the highway, and they're each with an AK-47 hidden on the far side of their body. And I came within a second of shooting a guy from Chicago. These guys were contractors from the rear security element for a convoy far up the road that we couldn't see. They just stopped to take a leak, basically, I guess. And I almost shot the second one from the left. He had a big pot belly, and I had the little red dot on him, and I had the weapon on semi. I was ready to put my fingers on the trigger. I was ready to pull, and the guy to the left of him, very smart, he turned his body, and it caught the light. I saw something flash, but that wasn't going to stop me. But through my intercom, I heard the vehicle commander say, "Badge, I've got a badge," and that's what stopped me from shooting him. So that was I remember thinking, wow, this is going to be a really long year.
It's actually pretty amazing to me how different the experiences two people can have. Like just listening to Brian describe his first day, and then I'm looking here at my journal entry from when we actually arrived in Iraq, and it's just so different. But I should probably start by introducing myself. So I'm Sandy Austin, and I was a sergeant in the U.S. Army Reserve. As we were driving in, and I just want to reflect on this. So as I'm driving, I was, of course, a little afraid, and they prep you on IEDs and if you're incoming fire and you know, maybe this person next to you isn't going to be there tomorrow. So, of course, you have this internal fear, but you're kind of pushing that away so that you don't just dwell on being afraid. And for me, I was focusing definitely much more on reading my journal entry, what sounds so much more positive to me. And so here we're driving in, and I'm noticing that we're passing all these small villages and that they're made up of these mud huts, and you see barefoot children, you saw men and women balancing baskets on their head. Anyway, so to me, I'm seeing this new nation, and I felt like a tourist seeing all of this, and I wanted to stop and meet these people. And I remember thinking, well, how are we supposed to make this functional democracy that we're supposedly here? And that's our job. That's our job. And here I'm looking here, and I'm like, do these people even want to be changed? So anyway, I was happy to be seeing such a different world. But underneath that tourist feeling was I was definitely afraid, and I was definitely hiding those feelings.
My first day in Iraq. My name is Dylan Tett. I was at the time an executive officer in the 5th Battalion, 20th Infantry Regiment. I remember this pretty well. Pulling out of Camp Udar, if you can imagine, hundreds of vehicles tracking mud over a street, a highway. A Kuwaiti car spun out of control after it had hit the mud that we had tracked onto this road. And there was a fatality, and the others were in serious critical condition. And we haven't even crossed the border yet and in a way caused this tragic accident. I also remember, and I have this picture hanging on my wall. It's a photo taken right before we crossed the berm into Iraq. And in the picture is myself, my driver, and my vehicle commander. And, you know, our uniforms are clean, our kit and our equipment was sparkling clean. I mean, compared to what would become of it, I mean, in a way, on the inside as well, you know, it was kind of our last moment before our lives would be changed forever. And I look at that picture now and I smile. it's neat.
Oh, can I ask Sandy a question real quick? I was just going to ask, what kind of vehicle were you driving?
We were in a Humvee, just a regular. It wasn't even...
It wasn't up armored?
No, it wasn't up armored.
Yeah, you guys were the ones that I remember thinking, man, you guys are brave, because we were in, the Striker, and I was really confident. Later, we were hit by an RPG, and it just proved to me how strong they were,
Crazy. But, yeah, I was actually the second vehicle in the convoy. But later, when we were in Iraq, we actually drove SUVs for a little bit. We weren't even in a Humvee. And then when I was home on leave, my team got hit by an RPG in an SUV. So that was kind of crazy.
Yeah, and when we were in that first vehicle, and I did say it was very tense in a lot of ways, and we were sort of amped up, but we had jerry-rigged the intercom system in the vehicle so we could play music and stuff. So some of the guys' CDs and stuff, we were playing through there. And Sergeant Zavala, my counterpart, he was in the back, I remember at one point, singing songs in Spanish with no musical accompaniment, and it really kind of calmed people down,
Yeah, that's true. We did the same thing. Soldiers are alike, We had... AC/DC or pumping through the intercom, which was a big no-no.
I was in Iraq from 3rd of December 2003 to just before Halloween of 2004.
I was in Iraq from December 03 to October 04.
I was in Iraq from December 03 until October 2004.
I departed Iraq via a C-130.
So my memories of my last day in Iraq.
The last 2 days I was in Iraq, I worked on this one poem. So should I read the poem?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's called Night in Blue. At 7,000 feet and looking back, running lights blacked out under the wings and America waiting. A year of my life disappears at midnight. The sky a deep viridian. The house lights below, small as match heads burned down to embers. Has this year made me a better lover? Will I understand something of hardship, of loss? Will a lover sense this in my kiss or touch? What do I know of redemption or sacrifice? What will I have to say of the dead? That it was worth it? That any of it made sense? I have no words to speak of war. I never dug the graves in Tel Afar. I never held the mother crying in Ramadi. I never lifted my friend's body when they carried him home. I have only the shadows under the leaves to take with me, the quiet of the desert, the low fog of Balad, orange groves with ice forming on the rinds of fruit. I have a woman crying in my ear late at night when the stars go dim, moonlight and sand as a resonance of the dust of bones, and nothing more. So I wrote that poem as if I was already on that plane, but that's what I'd spent doing, just sitting there. Guys were playing cards, joking, talking about what they were going to do back home, what girls they were hoping to hook up with, or what clubs they were going to go to, what they were going to drink first or eat first, that meal that they'd been imagining for a year, that kind of thing.
I have a little comment on that too, just about touching down. To me, that's like the real, when you actually feel everything. So we landed in North Carolina, and so nobody's family was really there, but we had this whole group of people there to greet us, and they were playing the Star Spangled Banner, and we all stood there, and I just remember crying. Ooh, gonna get me all teary right now, but it was just such an amazing feeling, like, to actually be on your own soil.
Yeah.
Ooh, sorry about that.
Yeah.
Anyway, but then here's the funny part. So we get off the plane, and they're playing the Star Spangled Banner, and there's a bass drum, which I must say, they need to leave the bass drum out of the Welcome Home Star Spangled Banners, because every time they would hit that, it would just kind of make you jump like it was a mortar coming in. Anyway.
Yeah.
I departed Iraq via a C-130, which is an aircraft cargo plane, and I remember sitting at the airfield in Mosul, and a report had come about some kind of rocket activity or missile activity, and we did a near vertical takeoff. But I remember as my body was leaving the earth, this enormous rush of relief come over me. I was, in the back of my mind, I had this self-inflicted prophecy that I was going to be replaced by my newborn son, who was born while I was in Iraq, and we were supposed to share the same birthday. And I just felt that it was paranoia, but, you know, he would do the things that I never got to do. And, you know, as I left the ground, it was kind of the last check that said, you know what, I survived and I'm not going to be replaced. It felt good. It felt really good.
I just got a phone call from a guy that was in my squad. He asked me to give him a recommendation if I got called for a security clearance because he wants to work for Blackwater.
Whoa.
He could be someone coming in on this weekend. And he's going in a very different way than what we've been talking about. And I told him not to get insert expletive shot. Don't get yourself shot over there.
Good advice, Brian.
Yeah, you know? and this relates to our last day in Iraq, because our last day in Iraq is also sort of tied to our first day back in America. Do you know what I mean?
Oh,
or
yes.
Back home, in a way. I remember there were retirees, World War II vets, and they shook our hands. And they didn't say anything about the war, if it was good or bad or whatever, any of that kind of thing. They just said, you know, welcome home. And that's a lesson we've learned since Vietnam, you know, of how do you treat the warrior regardless of where you may stand politically.
Former Army soldiers, now civilians, Brian Turner, Sandy Austin, and Dylan Tett.
You know, it's hard not to get emotional when you listen to how happy they were to finally make it home. But they said it, and vets will tell you that distance getting home emotionally takes a lot more time. And like S. Sandy Austin said, you know, to stop flinching every time you hear those bass drums beating.
Yeah, it takes a lot longer than one plane trip
exactly.
To get home. Here in Minnesota, the National Guard has a program called Beyond the Yellow Ribbon. It offers classes to help soldiers reintegrate back into civilian life after tours of duty. And it helps families also know what to expect about their loved ones coming home.
Exactly. Like, think of the people who sent teenagers away from war and just how transformed they must be when they come back home. And I know that program actually has classes for parents of the returning teenagers, returning soldiers, for spouses who have had to hold down the fort literally while their loved one was over in Iraq.
It's a team effort, really.
Exactly. And it's not easy for them to kind of reintegrate back into the family.
And for those of you who don't live in Minnesota, don't worry, there are videos that you can see about these subjects on their website.
The program's Beyond the Yellow Ribbon at our website, weekendamerica.org. He's Al Duhon. He's a pro golfer in his 80s, and he's here to take your money. Coming up on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where people can stay in touch with who they know and what they love. You can discover unsigned musicians, discuss books, share pictures, and keep up with the world. People are talking. Gather.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert. Mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at Calvert.com.
From American Public Media, I'm Desiree Cooper with John Moe. This weekend, weather permitting, you might be headed to the links, or if not, at least to a golf dome. I know, you avid golfers out there, nothing stops you from getting on the course. Weekend America's Charlie Schroeder went to a public golf course in Los Angeles, and he talked to an old pro who got bitten by the golf bug, and he beat some pretty big odds to conquer the sport.
One weekend, back in 1950... Al Duhon decided he'd go play golf. So he went to his local public golf course.
And this guy jumped on my back. He said, come on, let's bet. I didn't know what betting was. I didn't know whether he was... I said, bet? Yeah, okay. I thought you had to say okay, you know, so...
Duhon was 25 at the time and hadn't played the game very much. Furthermore, he didn't really get golf, especially the people who played no matter what the weather.
You know what I mean? I said, gee, them guys out there in the rain and everything. I said, they gotta be crazy.
So Duhon wasn't much competition for his opponent.
When we finished, he said, you owe me $25. I said, $25? See, you gotta be kidding. So I had to pay him. That was my last money. Didn't have any more money at all.
Duhon may not have had any money, but what he did have was an epiphany. And this was it.
Jesus Christ. I didn't know it was money in this game.
After losing that bet, Duhon practiced in his South Los Angeles yard for 6 months straight. He'd hit chip shots back and forth over his car. He'd even launch balls over his neighbor's homes and onto a schoolyard more than 200 yards away. Once his game was sufficiently in shape, he went back out to the golf course.
Went back out there, beat that guy out of my $25.
The game Duhon once labeled crazy had bit him. Hard.
Just like taking dope, you know what I mean? Playing golf. A guy falls in love with it so much. I mean, it's just something you just can't get away from.
That Al started playing golf at all might surprise most people. For one thing, his parents didn't play. For another, he grew up in Depression-era segregated Beaumont, Texas.
My family was so poor that we used to put cardboards in our shoes, you know. And they were always, shoes always too big. And we had to kind of walk on our heels from my house to the paved street, you know, to keep from walking in the water, you know.
When Duhon was 7, he started hustling for his family after his father was blackballed for unionizing at the local oil refinery. Consider his resourcefulness after the local Baptist church wouldn't give him bread because his family was Catholic. Duhon called on his rather intimidating dog, Black Beauty.
My dog came in with me, and they tried to take that bread away from me. Boy, that dog raised all kind of hell. So I just took the bread and went on home with him.
Here's a little golf history for you, circa 1960, 10 years after Al first bet on the golf course. There weren't any African Americans on the PGA Tour. In fact, there wouldn't be until the next year when Charlie Sifford finally broke the color barrier. In 1960, Duhon was making $105 a week working at a plastics factory, but he was making nearly that much in one day on the golf course.
If I'd go out there and play on like on a Sunday and win me about $50, you know what I mean?
Later that year, the plastics company where Duhon worked was sold. Rather than getting another job, he turned to hustling golf full-time.
And I'd say, well, I'll just play golf. I knew I could win me at least $150, $200 a week, so that's what I did.
Now, this idea that golfers hustle might seem a bit strange. I mean, isn't that what happens in pool halls? But on any given day, Duhon could play in games where $1,000 was on the line. Games that mostly took place at Chester, Washington, a golf course in South Los Angeles known as a hustling hotbed.
When I walk up there, they say, oh, here comes Al Duhon, come on, let's go. And then you didn't have to worry about getting your bags out of the car. They will help you get your bags out of the car.
Duhon became so savvy that he developed a pre-match betting strategy.
My method was if I shook a guy's hand and he had coins in his hand.
That's to say, calluses.
He's dead. I know I'm going to beat him.
Because golfers who don't know how to hold the club don't know how to play.
In one position, he had the wrong grip. Next position, he had his club in his hand too weak because it's rubbing up and down. Or he either had it too tight in his hand and it gets away from him and makes coins in your hand.
Despite making his living on the golf course, Duhon desperately wanted to be taken seriously. And it finally happened for him in 1982 when he was 52 years old. That year, he was the only black golfer competing in the U.S. Senior Amateur in Tucson. During his practice round, a reporter approached him.
So he asked me, what am I doing there? I said, I'm down here to kick somebody's That's what I said. I said, I'm here to kick somebody's That's what I'm here for. So the guy wrote it up in the paper, and everybody was speaking to me.
Turns out nobody had to speak to him. Duhon won the tournament to become only the second African-American to win a USGA title.
When I got through playing in 36 holes that day, I drove all the way back to L.A. without even getting sleepy, thinking about what happened in my lifetime. You know what I mean? So that was the greatest moments of my life.
At the age of 65, Duhan finally turned pro. He played a few years on the senior tour, continued to hustle, and in his spare time taught kids in South L.A. about the game. Now he's 83 and still teaching things like how to hold the club and...
respect, how to dress. If you dress like a fool, they're going to treat you like a fool.
As for hustling?
No, I don't hustle anymore. But if a guy bet, you know, I'll bet it. You know what I mean?
My money's on Al. I'm Charlie Schroeder for Weekend America.
In this postscript, 2 years ago, Al Duhan traveled to the home of golf, St. Andrews, Scotland. He went with some of his students and Charlie Siffert. In 2004, Siffert became the first African-American to be inducted in the World Golf Hall of Fame. And that was the first time either man had played the course in Scotland. To see what Al Duhan's swing looks like now in his 80s, you can go to our website, weekendamerica.org. He's still looking good.
And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Al, hope you're collecting some money on some golf course this weekend. I'm John Moe.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. You can download a free podcast of our entire program at weekendamerica.org. It's your weekend. Enjoy it.
Is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Picture this. It's Friday night or Saturday afternoon. You're home. No, wait. You're driving in your car. What song are you listening to?
It's really spastic, but it also has undertones of something a little bit more serious.
I'm ready to bust a move. I'm Bill Radke, the host of Weekend America. Join us each week as we capture the sound of your weekend.